Welcome to the Second Reading Podcast from the University of Texas at Austin.
The Republicans were in the Democratic Party because there was only one party.
So I tell people on a regular basis, there is still a land of opportunity in America. It's called Texas.
The problem is these departures from the Constitution, they have become the norm.
At what point must a female senator raise her hand or her voice to be recognized over the male colleagues in the room?
And welcome back to the Second Reading Podcast. I'm Jim Henson, director of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin. And it's poll release day here.
Woo!
That's Josh Blank cheering our work in the background, or not even the background, jumping in with a cheer.
Pew, pew, pew. Those are the fire. I'm shooting guns in the air.
This feels very much like the first summer podcast.
Yeah, this is. I'm in shorts. You
know, maybe it's the shorts.
Sound effects.
I don't know. Shorts and sound effects.
It's summer.
So we come to you having released our June poll earlier this morning. We're recording late morning or early afternoon now, June 23rd. We were talking about this offline this morning, Josh. And this, you know, maybe we say this every other podcast. I don't know. But, you know, I felt a little, all right, we got some interesting things in here. We'll see how it goes. But in retrospect, or now that we've got the data, kind of chock full of interesting stuff.
Yeah, I mean, you know, you asked me, or you didn't ask me. There's a note in the you know, landing page release that we write up about, you know, which poll is this? And it's like, I had to go back and count them again and stuff. And this is the 74th poll in the time series. And I think one of the challenges in some ways with that, there's like opportunities and challenges, right? Like one of the great opportunities of that, or one of the great benefits of it, is you really get to like notice these sort of like micro adjustments. And I think in some ways, I think for both of us, I can say for myself, certainly, I'm a lot less inclined to react to a result, you know, without enough support.
Oh, it's moving.
It's moving. Yeah. Cause you know, stuff moves. That's the nature of polling, you know, I mean, it's a sample, but you know, having said all that, one of the things that you look for in these polls, and one of the things that, you know, over time you look at, is you look for, you know, sort of things that change in a way that looks, what I like to say is internally consistent, you know, where it's not one result that's moved in a particular direction or bounce, but you're looking at a series of results that are presenting themselves in such a way that makes you say, huh, that's kind of interesting. And I think this poll, in addition to having, you know, some very specific things that are very interesting, we're going to talk about some of them today, we'll talk about some of them, you know, in the next couple of weeks, and you'll see some of them on the website, or go look through it all if you want. You know, there was sort of an overarching piece to this that was interesting to me in this particular poll that just looked a little bit different than a lot of the other surveys that we've done. And not compositionally.
Yeah, talk a little bit about that. I'm interested in that. Yeah.
And so there are a couple of things I think that are noticeable to me, and it sort of falls broadly under sort of these two political science concepts in some ways that we talk about, but they're kind of, you know, it's interesting to see them working together or against each other. So I'll tell you what I mean. So when we talk about polarization all the time, right, and we talk about the way that, you know, sort of Democrats have these overwhelmingly negative views of Republicans, and in general, their views are really overwhelmingly, let's just say, to one pole if you have like two options, right? And Republicans are the opposite, right? They're all the way on the other side.
The poles of the polls.
The poles of the poll. Yes, perfect. That's great. That's good stuff. We'll get that in post. Anyway, there's no post. Anyway, and, you know, so that's just sort of a normal thing. You know, if you've looked at our graphics and you click on the party ID thing, you're used to seeing sort of the steps kind of going up in the two different directions with Republicans on one side, Democrats on the other, and independents in the middle. And that's all normal. And then, but what's interesting today is when we talk about polarization, we're talking about the fact that, you know, there's no Democrats over in the Republican group and no Republicans over in the Democratic group. And I think this poll, it was like that, and that's usually the case, but it was almost on steroids in some sense. Huh. And in particular, on the Democratic side, what was really noticeable was there were multiple instances in which you see something like 97 or 98% of Democrats with, let's just say, a very unfavorable opinion of the president or strongly opposed, strongly to whatever, right? And just to say, that's unusual.
Like, yeah, and it's not so much the direction, it's the intensity.
It's the intensity. It's very unusual to be running these surveys and to see anything close to 100%. Even if you ask a question in which the answer should be 100%, you expect there to be a little bit of measurement error, you expect some respondents to be a little bit lazy, and then it's 98%. And you say 1% of people would do that?
Yeah.
No, it's just, you know, it's an estimate. It happens. But what was notable is that, you know, even in attitudes that we're used to seeing, you know, 85% of Democrats. Now we're seeing 95, 97, 98%.
Yeah.
And across the board, too. I mean, that's the other thing about it, too, is, you know, you look at their attitudes towards Trump, sure, negative. But then you look at their attitudes towards Abbott, very negative. You look at their attitudes towards Paxson, extremely negative. You look at their attitudes towards Cruz, very negative. And kind of across the board, the intensity and the consistency of the negativity in Democratic attitudes towards the ruling class and a lot of these policies is really even beyond, I think, what we normally see.
Yeah.
Now, the flip side of that, when we talk about polarization, is on the Republican side, it's interesting, right? Because it's a little bit more complicated. And at the most basic way, I'd say, you know, that's the challenges of governing, you know, in some sense, right? I mean, there is just a natural lack of satisfaction that is going to be apparent when you have the party in power and they're not achieving everything or everything the way you want or whatever. And also just issues are thrown at you and maybe you handle it well or maybe you don't. And so we've already talked about some of this and the fact that there are pockets of negativity among Republicans over things like the president's handling of inflation and prices, for example. You know, so you've got about a quarter of Republicans not happy about that, right? But then what's interesting is that when you break all these attitudes down, again, Democrats are firmly pushing to the left. But what you notice is that there is some positivity among Republicans. So in this poll, what you see is that even though their attitudes remain pretty negative on all the macro features, what I've noticed is you see a little bit of an uptick in their attitudes towards the president, towards the governor. But when you look deep into those numbers, it's – and especially even if you look over time, let's say we're looking at this poll, we could be looking at April, we could be comparing this to a couple of years ago, whatever. Most of that gain in any sort of Republican – positivity within the party is really only coming from the most committed Republicans. So when we ask people to identify their partisanship, we look for the strength of their partisanship as well. So we talk about Democrats and independents, Republicans, but we think there's also, you know, gradations to that.
Sure.
And for various reasons, I don't want to get too detailed about because we can get to a whole question about partisan leaners and other stuff. So let's just set that aside for the dorks for the after hours version of the podcast.
Right. Yeah. Because there's an interesting thing going on with the leaners.
But that's part of it too, actually.
It shows up more in the ideological stuff.
Right.
Yeah. Ideological reading.
But what you're seeing is that, you know, I think, and again, I'm trying to paint a broad picture without jumping on any specific results. It could take for hours and we'll probably write something up about this. But what you're seeing the strong Republicans, the most committed voters, the most ideologically committed Republicans are kind of saying, yes, please. This is good. I like this. And they're actually looking a little bit more positively towards most of the things that we've seen and that we measure, while the rest of the Republicans are kind of like, you know, I mean, I'd say they're supportive, but with these pockets of resistance. Democrats are overwhelmingly against pretty much all of it, and independents are overwhelmingly against pretty much all of it. And so to set that up to move into sort of the election piece, what strikes me about this is something we've been talking about. This is sort of putting some, without putting numbers to it, but putting a little bit more heft behind this notion that, you know, one of the challenges I think facing Republicans this election cycle, besides, you know, the overall environment or an aspect of the environment, is that Trump remains so overwhelmingly popular amongst the most committed Republicans. And these are the people who show up in primaries, these are the people who go knock on doors, these are the people who are going to donate money, right? These are the people who are watching Fox News or Newsmax or listening or whatever, right? These are those Republicans. And they are down. You know, they're for what's going on in the leadership that we've seen generally. The problem is that, you know, you've got the less committed Republicans who will probably, you know, I think the polling is going to show are going to come along most likely. But as we've talked about in competitive environments, you can't lose too many of those guys. And there's still large pockets of dissatisfaction among the less committed Republicans. And then you go and you say, well, what about the groups that are up, you know, for competition, like independents, suburbanites? And it's like, you know, they're not happy. Like independents look very unhappy. And that's pretty, I'd say at this point, I think they might be settling into like a pretty consistent negative range. I think it's going to take another poll or two.
Yeah.
But it looks like if we have one more, I mean, by then we'll be at the election, but it looks like they're settling into a negative band pretty much.
Those with an opinion, right?
Yeah, right.
Which is tricky with them. We can come back to that.
And then in Democrats, you've got overwhelmingly unified, intense attitudes. And so I think, you know, when you think about that, you really sort of, you know, crystallizes, I think, the challenge that Republicans face. And you can kind of see them playing with it right now, which is, you know, do they spend time trying to, let's say, ding Tallarico and try to maybe put a dent in Democratic enthusiasm, maybe, you know, pop the...
Move a few of those independents.
Those independents, right. You know, remind some of those Republicans why, you know, maybe, you know, they shouldn't even consider the other side, even though I don't think that's their biggest issue. Or is it, you know, do they need to basically focus more on kind of bringing these Republicans who are a little bit reticent at the moment back into the fold? And can you do those two things at once or not?
Well, I was going to say, well, you know, I mean, it's not...
They're not inconsistent with each other necessarily.
They're not. I mean, I guess the question is what would the means of doing the, you know, smoothing over some of the rough edges, what would that look like?
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what that is.
I think the challenge is that I think...
Because the issue stuff is not that different.
No, I think, look, I mean, I think in general, the answer is the same as it always is, which is, you know, Tallarico is the most extreme politician who's ever tried to run
campaign,
for... Yeah, it's a negative. It's the usual thing. I mean, the problem is that, you know, it's been heard. You know, I mean, it's not a new argument. And, you know, I think, look, you've already made this point. I don't know what the answer is, and I'm not being paid to figure it out. I think this is what the summer is about, and this is what people are testing. But, I mean, what you can see right now is they're not sure either. I think, you know, you look back at the Republican convention, you see Dan Patrick saying that James Tallarico is going to go to hell, and it's like, well, you know, okay. I mean, that's an approach. There's this whole sort of, you know, trying to turn Tallarico's Christianity against him, which I've said before, I think is risky. But it's also risky when, like, you know— I think the candidate running against him, I mean, I don't know the sins, like the Ten Commandments off the top of my head, but he's, I think it's at least two or three, right? I mean, I'm just right. Like, straight up. So, I mean, if I think that's one of those things where it's an
Caught red-handed in a couple. You know, sort of plea bargained on a couple.
Yeah.
You know.
Well, anyway, yeah. I'm not that kind of scholar, but obviously, but I think, you know, that's one of those things where you're walking into an uncomfortable space if you're going to do that. So, I mean, we're still watching this, but I do think there's something that bears watching here, which is just to say, I haven't seen, you know, this extent of Democratic, you know, sort of unity in anything, first of all, just in terms of opinions, I think, in the time period that we've looked at for the most part. And the cracks in the Republican, you know, sort of wall here, well, not like overwhelming. It's notable that, you know, I mean, the whole, one of the big messages from their convention was unity. We're together, grassroots, elites. Yeah, you knock some of our guys off. We're all still good. You know, we're going to go out and we're going to do this. But in fact, I've been saying this to a lot of reporters, you know, that meeting represents this one slice of the party. It's a slice of the party that's actually in some ways probably happier with the direction of the country, probably happier with the president's performance on a lot of things, and unsure why, you know, probably more open to the arguments about what Texas Republicans have failed at thus far. And that's just not really, I think, the environment. I mean, this is the environment they're trying to fix before the summer kind of really, you know, gets to the end, I think.
Well, I think on that particular point, I mean, the dynamic that's interesting there, I think, is something that came up in one of the posts that we've done in the last few weeks. I think it was the 2026-2018 one that kind of ended with the negative polarization piece and all of that. I think that was that one. Is that it? The degree to which, you know, you were talking about the dominant vibe at the convention and the dominant faction that's kind of there is that, you know, on one hand, as you said, they're pretty happy with what they're getting.
Yeah.
Right? On the other hand, they still want more.
Well.
Right? So, you know, I think what we were looking at was kind of approval of the party.
Well.
And the do we want to go broken down by degrees of conservatism and is the party conservative enough?
Well, but then here's the other piece to all this, which is sort of the thing that I think is the bigger kind of political science going forward question of all this, which is despite, you know, again, very positive views amongst the most committed Republicans for their leaders, despite, you know, really negative views from Democrats and really, but at the same time, I'll say really positive views from Democrats towards their standard bearer in this cycle, Tallarico. Yeah. But when we ask about attitude towards the party— and the parties in general, they're so negative.
Yeah.
They're just generally negative. The partisan views of the parties are generally negative. I mean, they're within reasonable bands, but it's not as though, I mean, I say this, you know, you don't look at this and say, yeah, the parties are strong. You say these politicians are, I mean, in some ways Trump breaks through everything.
Well.
And kind of dictates all of this. I mean, I guess, let me just throw this out to you and I want you to respond. I can't help but think about the negative views of the party on the one hand. And then we also ask questions about favorability towards MAGA and towards democratic socialism on the other. And I think what's surprising in the favor, generally, let's say the general availability of favorable attitudes towards both constructs indicates to me, you know, a certain unmooring of people from some of these partisan identifications in some ways, potentially, because we're seeing differences in the ways the data looks when we look at the different groups in ways that are kind of notable. We see, you know, very strong attitudes towards the elite leaders and elected, you know, elected people that people know about, negative views of the party, and openness to these alternative constructs all at once.
Yeah.
It's pretty, you know.
And it's not that the views are so negative, but they're lukewarm, right?
They're lukewarm at best. Yeah. You know, they're very negative towards the other party.
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah, they're very out. No, just to be clear, they're very negative towards the out party, which is really the driving force here.
Yeah,
and then
I think
the party itself is kind of, yeah, I mean, which in some ways kind of answer the question. It's like, why MAGA? Why Trump? You know, why Paxton, Huffines, these sort of people coming in from askew of this? And you could say, well, you know, when most of the animating force behind the party becomes those guys are evil, we can't let them have power. Well, I think the politics that underlines that clearly changes, right? I mean, you're not really trying to solve people's problems. I see this for both sides. You're trying to stop the other side.
Right. Well, and it's something that, again, we're, you know...
It's waxing here.
Yeah. I mean, we're kind of going in a different direction, but this is great. I mean, I think what it invites, and it's a complicated discussion, and I've been thinking about it, haven't thought it through completely, but I kind of waved at it either in the mailer or the post. I can't remember, but, you know, kind of waved at the fact that, look, on one hand, there's this interesting finding in the poll that I was going to leave to the end that you flagged those. The embrace of the respective partisans of MAGA on one hand, which is overwhelmingly positive.
Yeah.
You know, and then the surprisingly large, but not as big and not as intense and positive or favorable, you know, amount of favorable views of democratic socialism, which we polled. And you can find these results in the post and on the site at texaspolitics.utexas.edu. But part of figuring this out is the difference in those two constructs.
Yeah.
You know, not to be all...
No, you're right. No.
My abstract or whatever. But I mean... And this, you know, speaks to how we've kind of wrestled with how to test these things.
No, it's
right because they're similar in their gravitational pull a little bit as identifiable centers of gravity or forces within each party. But to the point I think you were kind of making, you know, MAGA is not an ideological construct per se. I mean, it's an ideological construct in the big sense of ideology, but not in the left-right sense of ideology that we think of in terms of political behavior and political psychology. But it is, you know, it's much more personalistic.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, you don't have MAGA without Trump.
Right.
And I haven't looked at the fave-unfaves on Trump and MAGA next to each other, but I'll bet they're pretty damn close.
Yeah, I bet.
Right? Democratic socialism is something different.
Yeah.
Right? It's a different kind of ideological construct, sorry.
No need.
You know, but you know, and so you know, the dynamics of the influence of those two things are very different. I mean, as you were talking about, you know, Trump and MAGA and then candidates in Texas like Paxton and Huffines, it's almost as if Trump and MAGA are creating, you know, this big force going through the party. And then people are selectively traveling in the wake of that.
Yeah.
And they're figuring out where, you know, the currents that will really carry them are. And they're not completely divorced from far-right conservatism or, you know, I mean, you know, when Dan Patrick stands on the stage at the Republican convention and says, yeah, I'm proud to be called a Christian nationalist. We all are now, et cetera.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, you can't look at that as not an ideological construct that's not about Trump at all.
Yeah. I like that. I really like that analogy, though, because, I mean, the Christian national construct in Texas has been, you know.
Right.
Present for a while and has, you know, probably increased in terms of its overall whatever potency or salience or whatever. But what's nice about the way that analogy is that, you know, the MAGA boat goes through and creates the wake, and then it's like, well, how do you want? Does this go in here?
Yeah, right.
Yeah, we can try. You know,
right. I think, see all these guys on wakeboards going. Yeah, it's good.
But I think what's so surprising. I think, you know, you can speak to this even more. It's like, and again, setting aside the whole, you know, ideological construct, concepts,
depth
of all this stuff, blah blah blah. Because I don't think that people responding to democratic socialism in a survey I don't think any person on average responding to democratic socialism in a survey has a really strong, deep sense of like what exactly that means.
The debates between the Second and Third International.
But I think what's surprising is, you know, we've been doing this for a while, and, you know, do you think in I don't know, 2012, 2013, if we'd asked for democratic socialism favorability, 60% of Texas Democrats would have said, yep, favorable. Yeah, I mean, just the word socialism should have probably...
I just don't think so.
Yeah, and that's right. So that's what I say. And real quick, just to be clear, you know, so when I say, you know, surprising, you know, it's 29 favorable, 46 unfavorable, not surprising, you know, but Democrats were 68, independents were 22, 38, so 1 in 5 independents, right? You know, 39% of 18 to 29 year olds compared to 32% with an unfavorable attitude, 38% of 30 to 44 year olds with 32% with an unfavorable attitude. Those flip pretty dramatically when you get a little bit older. But that speaks to the moment we're in some ways, to my mind. And I don't like, you know, we're not, you know, I think anybody who listens to this, we're not like, oh, this guy's falling, you know, all that stuff. But there's a lot going on in here that's pretty remarkable and interesting in terms of sort of the history and trajectory of Texas politics, to think that, you know, you could put socialism in anything and get a 60% positive response among Democrats, or a plurality positive response amongst under 45 or whatever.
And I know that one could be listening to this of a certain mindset and say, well, yeah, we told you all along that that's what was really going on.
Yeah.
I don't think that's
right.
I think it's, but it's also part of the dynamic when we talk, if we're going to talk about negative partisanship, there's going to be people looking at that going, see?
But, you know, this is really important because we're going to eventually talk about the election. But look, I mean, Bernie Sanders is coming to Corpus Christi tomorrow, right? Or this week, to talk at the state party convention.
Yeah.
That's, you know, I mean, you're shaking your head. Yeah, that's something, right? You know, now look, maybe whether that was, my impression is that people from out of state wanted to participate in this, from what I can piece together. And it wasn't so much that the state Democratic Party was like, you know who we need?
Right.
We need some Bernie Sanders here. I don't think that's it, but they're also not in a situation where they would tell anyone not to come at this point. But it is sort of notable to think of Bernie Sanders' trajectory, and the idea is in this election year in which Democrats feel like the wind's at their back and they're like, yeah, let's get Bernie down here. And that speaks to the point that, you know, Abbott was quick to say, oh, we'll see, of course, to your point, this is what it's been about all along.
Yeah.
But I think it's also the case that you can, I mean, I don't agree with that, but I would say this represents something of a shift of the underlying ground.
Well, and speaking of the, you know, looking at the one data point and kind of wondering, you know, you were pointing out offline this morning, the shift in the idea, you know, the shift in this poll in the ideological composition of Democrats.
Right. So we pointed out that, you know, one of the interesting consequences of Trump's first term in office was that liberal identification among Democrats went up substantially during his first term. And in this last poll, it hit a new high for Democrats. I know 79% of Democrats, is that right?
I think that's right.
Let me make sure that's right. But anyway, it's along those lines, but it was the highest that we had seen in the entire time series of the poll in terms of liberal identification among Democrats. And this is what we saw during the last Trump era. We're saying, now, is this in response to Trump? Is this because of political entrepreneurs like a Sanders, like others, using the wake of Trump to try something else?
As I was thinking, as we were talking about kicking that back and forth, I mean, as I was discussing this with my wife this morning, we were commenting on, you know, basically what was the Democratic boat that we didn't use the metaphor then, but that created that wake, and it was Sanders. I mean, that's a, you know, well, we're going to look back in retrospect. And,
no, we talked about this at the time. I mean, when Trump and Sanders were both kind of running insurgent candidacies in their respective parties back in that year, you know, we talked about this on this podcast. Like, it was strange in the sense that they were both actually making a lot of similar criticisms of the system, just from completely different sides, you know?
And, you know, at Sanders, you'd have to go back a little further, but at the beginning of the Sanders rise as a national figure, I mean, he was an outsider.
Yeah.
Right? I mean, this was like, people are like, what is this?
Yeah.
You know?
Trade.
So let's talk a little bit about in the Senate races. That was good. I mean, I'd rather do that than summarize races. Anyway.
Yeah, for sure. I agree.
Okay. But let's, you know, let's
give the people what they came for.
Well, you know, I don't know. Who knows what y'all are coming from. You know, let us know why
you're here at all.
That's been a question in my mind for a decade now. But the top line, let's start with the Senate race. Yeah. So the top line showed, interestingly, a very close race. And I think actually all this stuff does connect.
Yeah.
Right? So at the top line, Republican Ken Paxton, 43%. Democrat James Tallarico, 42%. Libertarian Ted Brown, 3%, an unspecified someone else. For those of you going, someone else isn't on the ballot, you can write somebody in, 3%. And then 10% with no opinion, right?
Right.
And we should, just from a technical point, this is our first technical trial ballot.
Yeah.
And right, where we had, you know, we had people, and I understand this, kind of complaining or making suggestions. I won't call it complaining. I'm supposed to be, hearing I'm too sensitive, but, you know, saying, hey, you've put the Libertarian on there all the time right away. But there are reasons we didn't do that. And, you know, we can litigate that another time.
Yeah.
So that's what we get. So a 1-point race, you know, effectively margin of error statistic. We won't say it's a tie. We'll say they're statistically indistinguishable.
Because you can't say that.
But now, so I'm curious, what was your response when you saw this? I mean, I know, you know, tell us what your response was. But what do you glean? What stands out to you in the group breakdowns, crosstabs? What's, you know, in the numbers below the top line?
Yeah, I mean, I think the most important thing that stands out to us first, of course, is the consolidation of Republican support by Ken Paxton, right? Yeah. I mean, when we did the sort of, you know, we wouldn't even call it a trial ballot, just set aside all that discussion.
Hypothetical head-to-heads, I've called them, as gracelessly as possible.
Right, and setting aside the hypothetical April head-to-head, in that poll, Paxton was pulling 63% support among Republicans, with a lot basically holding their fire, right? And 11% said they would support Tallarico. That's halved to 5%. And the share of Republicans who say they're going to support Ken Paxton is now up to 84%, barely trailing the 88% of Democrats who say they're going to be supporting James Tallarico.
So in a way, I would just summarize that by saying, for those more on the Democratic side, but also the Cornyn people saying, well, you know, you're just going to have a hard time reunifying Republicans, you know, asked and answered.
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I think the real challenge is everybody else. I mean, look, there
yeah,
is.
Yeah, well, and in that sense, the Cornyn fans and, you know, the Democratic optimists were, you know, there's some grist for them in this.
Yeah, and I'll say, look, I mean, I was just, because we've been doing this, so I may as well, you know, looking back at our, you know, trial ballot in June of 2018, we also had a Libertarian, someone else, and hadn't thought about enough to have an opinion yet. Cruz was up 41-36 over O'Rourke. So he had a 5-point lead, 2% for the Libertarian, 3% someone else, and a higher share, no opinion, 17%. Okay. I mean, I think that yeah. seems about, and to your point, you know, what did I think? I think, I mean, it's like, you asked me, I said, looks pretty good to me.
Right.
I mean, that seems pretty reasonable. Yeah. I think, you know, we expected Paxton to eat away, if not overcome, the lead that Tallarico is showing in the early polling because of all the reasons we've already discussed about and continue to discuss.
And it's why we thought the early polling was ultimately, I don't want to use the term, make a valuable judgment, but, you know, was not going to be indicative of much in terms of the general election.
It tells you what it tells you, which is that Republicans hadn't solidified yet.
Yeah.
And it doesn't matter because it was, you know, the spring, who cares, right? So now they've solidified. But then the question becomes, you know, to your point more broadly, like, why is it so close, right? I mean, because, I mean, one of the things, you know, you could, so again, is we're voicing, you know, the various criticisms that are coming. It's like we can hear them in our heads.
Yeah.
But, you know, someone says, well, that's because you got too many Democrats. No. There's more Republicans in the sample than there are Democrats because there are more Republicans in the state than Democrats, which is why this poll is as close as it is.
And we don't do that. We don't engineer the party mix.
It's just the demographics of the state and the partisan identification of the respondents produce a Republican advantage in Texas. Now, among independents, and this is sort of, you know, the key here, 40% prefer Tallarico, 12% say they prefer Paxton, 34% haven't thought about it enough to have an opinion. And that's where we start to see what the issue is that's making this a 1-point race. Now, I think more interestingly, in some ways, well, I mean, these are interesting. I mean, there's
and we're not chock full of independents here. The independents were 9%.
Yeah, it's 9. It was actually low in this poll, I think.
Yeah, a little bit. It's usually 11 or 12. It also happens usually in election season.
Yeah, people start. Well, there are people who are less partisan who get more pulled into the partisan stuff. You know, among Hispanics, Paxton's pulling 35%. Tallarico's 49%. That's something to keep an eye on. You know, can Tallarico grow that number? Is Paxton going to be able to grow that number much? But to me, I think the thing is, now that we've seen the solidification of Republicans, the real sort of comparison point to me is the gubernatorial trial ballot.
That's exactly right. And I think, you know, not to share, you know, too much of our anticipation, I guess. You know, you were joking about, well, I saw it. It's like, yeah, it looks pretty good to me. But it looked pretty good in context.
Yeah.
Right.
Well,
I mean, in terms of the draw,
I'm a big context guy.
Yeah, well,
I can't help it.
Yeah.
But that's exactly. So, look, you know, I said Paxton has a 1-point lead in this poll. By contrast, Abbott has a 7-point lead, 47-40 over Gina Hinojosa. 1% for the Libertarian, Pat Dixon, 2% for someone else, 10% haven't thought about it enough to have an opinion, which I will say again, that's pretty consistent. So that 10% on that top ticket race, I mean, part of that's a reflection. We've been talking about this a while. It's a little bit low.
In the two most
talked about
salient races for the offices that, you know, when we're not in election season, tend to have the highest name recognition, they're pretty, you know, the 10% is interesting.
Right. So again, let's make the same comparison. Looking back at June 2018, I'm not going to compare Valdez and Osa. I don't know. We'll wait and see. But Abbott was at 44 and Osa, and Valdez, I'm sorry, was at 32. So he had a 12-point lead starting out in June of that election year.
Right.
So I think, again, to the point, context matters. And I think, you know, to me, I'm looking at the context here and saying, okay, Abbott's got, you know, a relatively... a reasonably comfortable lead over Hinojosa, but less than I think he's historically used to.
Yes.
Right? We'd expect a bigger lead for him. But also, when we look at all the data, we talked about this, I think, in the last podcast 2 weeks ago, one of the major sort of differences here, in addition to more negative views of Trump, more negative views of the economy, is that, you know, Abbott's views towards Abbott are not as strong among Republicans, and they're much more negative among Democrats and independents. So a 12-point starting off point becomes 7.
And even with all that, 90%, you know, Abbott had 90% of Republicans.
He has 90% of Republicans, and Osa has 88% of Democrats. But again, the split among independents looks pretty similar, 12-41. Yeah. So it's pretty close to what it was for in the Paxton.
I think we're getting close to the time we're going to have to do that long promised independent
thing. I guess so. Anyway, we'll get back to that.
That's who we always say.
Yeah, I'm shaking my fist.
Right. But it's, you know, I mean, but also, again, 33% of independents with no preference, right?
Right. And so I think that's where we're going to, you know, we're going to see a lot of attention this summer. But I mean, I think, you know, this is, so, you know, what do you take from this? I mean, my takeaway is this is the manifestation of a lot of the activities that we've been seeing taking place over the last year and a half, right? Democrats think this year is going to be competitive, right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, if we're comparing this to 2018, which was a pretty competitive year, you know, yeah, I mean, this looks pretty good for Democrats. He had a 12-point lead, you know, in that trial ballot. There's a 7-point lead in this one. What did I say? You know, Cruz had a 5-point lead, which is a 1-point lead in this one. Now, that doesn't mean that, you know, it's going to, we're not on a trajectory here, a trend, but this reflects the competition that led a lot of Democrats to be interested in this race. It's an indication of the competition that has Bernie Sanders, Cory Booker, Pritzker, and all these other people going to Corpus Christi of all places to talk to a bunch of local Democrats because they think that this is a competitive state. If not now, maybe soon. Yeah.
Well, you know, competitive enough.
Yeah.
Well, from the perspective of those people coming in.
Well, and I think that's the other thing too. I mean, competitive enough, period, right? Because, I mean, ultimately, you know, I think what we've seen is that the geography of political competition has narrowed significantly and continues to narrow, especially with redistricting at the district level, right? And so it just happens that there are only so many, you know, House seats up that are competitive in any given election cycle. There are only so many Senate seats that are competitive in any given election cycle. And when you look at a state like Texas and you look at a governor as well-resourced and positioned within his party as Greg Abbott, I mean, one of the things I was saying to this reporter this morning about the differences between the Republican and the, you know, the Democratic convention, like, the Republicans don't need to invite Greg Abbott from out of state to come talk at their convention. He is the guy. Like, he'd be the guy they'd invite to come go talk somewhere else. Maybe even Ken Paxton too. Like, you know, Ted Cruz. These are guys who go elsewhere. They don't need that. But the idea that someone as well-positioned as Greg Abbott could have, you know, a 7-point lead at this point, which, you know, back in 2018 was 12 points, which back when he, you know, faced Wendy Davis was a 13-4, you know, I mean, going back to 20 points going back 10 years. Like, you can't help but look at this and think this is getting tighter. Now, some of that's environmental, but also some of it is just...
Yeah, and I looked and I can't remember, but it was a little bit closer in 2022 versus O'Rourke, I think.
It was still like 10 though, wasn't it?
I think, but I looked and I just can't
remember.
I'm
pretty sure it was, but...
You know, I'll riff while you...
Yeah, I'm looking it up right now.
So, you know... I think the other thing about that 7-point...
Yeah, it was still 10.
Yeah, about that 7-point gap is that it's replicated in the less salient, you know, in that range in the less salient races that we also polled right below
right,
that.
So Patrick's leading Goodwin by 7 points, 43 to 36, so it's the same gap.
With an increase in the number of undecideds.
Big increase in the number of undecideds. We go down to Attorney General. We see Middleton up 41-36 over Nathan Johnson.
Which was that's an interesting result that's one of the, I mean, you know, we're not talking about a huge gap, but, you know, that's a 5-point race, right?
Yeah.
You know, that's, with 2% on the with 2% for the Libertarian, helped by no Green Party candidate, 4% someone else. And, you know, if you look at the fave unfaves, neither of them is, you know, neither Mays Middleton nor Nathan Johnson.
Yeah.
Are, you know, well, just especially well known.
Yeah. And really, once you drop below the governor's race, not including Dan Patrick, most of the candidates below that are pretty unknown.
Because we should also remember there's no incumbents in either one of those races, right, that or the controller.
Yeah, and I wonder with that, I mean, the thing is, I don't want to overinterpret the attorney general
result either.
I mean, I do think, you know, it's easy to want to ask whether Middleton's embrace of Trump and branding of himself with MAGA is going to benefit him going forward, but I think it's still too soon to tell. I mean, that's one of
right.
the, you know, and obviously, look, 5.7 points. Let's not, you know, we're splitting hairs.
Yeah,
at a certain
point getting too crazy.
We could
about
get a little
that.
Crazy,
right?
And then, you know, also say, look, Huff Hines is up 6 points over Eckhart again, and these are two candidates largely unknown, right? So, to your point, I mean, some ways to look at this, you know, if we look at the sort of the basic kind of setup here, it's about a 6 or 7 point gap. It looks like right now, which,
right.
if you look at all the states that are in play. That's a competitive state.
Right. I mean, look, it's you know, to me, it's, and it's not just confirmatory of, it's confirmatory of a lot of people's judgment of the vibe.
Yeah.
Right. Which is, you've got the Senate race, which is another thing.
Yeah.
Right. And then you've got, okay, so what's like really going on in these state level races?
Mm-hmm.
And what's going on is, if you assume Republicans, you know, I've said this a few times on the podcast. I've had Republican pollsters consult themselves. You know, we should still assume a baseline, all things equal, not taking into account environmental factors, about a 10-point Republican advantage. You've got a big, brewing, seemingly very good, you know, Democrat-favorable environment. You know, five to seven is...
Yeah, that's...
You know, that gives us an estimate of, like... You know, we were talking a lot before,
right.
I stopped using it, but, you know, we've been talking, but I'll bring it back, talking about, you know, the magnitude of the wave and the size of the wall.
Yeah.
You know, waves a few points higher than normal, and, you know, so they're building the wall, and, you know, so far it seems to kind of hold as of now. And we should say that usually these numbers at this point, usually, I think, underestimate the Republican vote a little bit.
Yeah, I mean, look, one really,
all things equal.
Well, one
again.
Really important, this is registered voters, so you've got likely voters. So one of the things is, you know, we're not pulling out, you know, we're not filtering people here. Anybody who's registered vote can give us an opinion. So, I mean, one thing you can do is if you want to at home have some fun with this, you know, remove the haven't thought about enough to have an opinion.
Get out your Shaw envelope.
Yeah, exactly. You can use your envelope and recalculate these to see what it looks like without the people who don't have an opinion yet. But I forgot about that. I mean, that's a good point. The 10-point gap is a good point. It's a good, you know, starting point, because part of it is usually when we look, if you look at the back of most surveys that are conducted in Texas, what you're usually going to see is about a 10-point Republican advantage in party ID. It depends on how they measure independence and other things and when in time and blah, blah, blah. But around that range, if independents roughly split or go a little bit for the GOP, yeah, it's about a 10-point gap, you know. I mean, that makes perfect sense, right? That should happen. But as your point, it's like, okay, we given everything else we know it's probably less than 10. And then this are, yeah, five, yeah, six, seven. Yeah.
And the generic ballots are six.
Yeah, and the generic
in
ballots.
In both the legislature and Congress.
It's, right.
You know, Republican plus candidate plus six.
Right, exactly.
Specific.
And those are ones where there's nobody says, I don't know. They just choose one or the other and there's a someone else that they really don't want, but almost nobody chooses someone else. So when push comes to shove, if these people show up at the ballot box right now, again, 49-43 on the generic ballot, that's competitive.
Yeah, yeah, move it up a little closer. Yeah, it's competitive, but with a notable Republican advantage, which leads us to how do Republicans sort of approach this to some degree and moves us. Let's talk about data centers a little bit so we can at least touch on that before we get out of here. And I know.
It's all I want to talk about, though.
I'm a little bit of an obsessive. I've been a little bit of obsessive about this, but I'm feeling validated.
Man, it worked out.
I mean. You know, we somewhat muddled our way through the politics and the politics weren't so hard to muddle. We muddled a little through the policy stuff in the last podcast we did 2 weeks ago. Now we're back to look more directly at the politics because we included a couple of questions on the poll. So now we can actually look at the public opinion component.
Speak from knowledge, you mean.
A little more direct. Well, you know, I wouldn't even, you know, at least some evidence.
Okay, evidence, yeah.
So what do we get there? I thought interesting. Yeah. We kind of led, you know, if you're listening to this, you probably know we led with this right below the trial ballots in the polling report. But I think this is a fascinating result.
Yeah. So first, you know, we asked whether or not, you know, Texas voters support or oppose the construction of data centers in their community. Overall, majority opposition, 56% were opposed, 29% expressed support. Now, this is where it gets a little interesting, right? I mean, so 71% of Democrats and 62% of independents were opposed to the local construction of data centers. Fewer than one in five were supported. But among Republicans, split right down the middle, 42% support, 44% oppose. So I have some thought. I mean, what was your reaction?
Well,
to that?
No, wait, go ahead. I'm curious what you think, because we haven't talked about. I mean, you know, looked at it and went, "Oh, wow, look at that," and then worked.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's really interesting to me because I mean, I can't say that the news that has come out about data centers has been positive generally, and I don't think that there's a lot of indication that people have. Yeah, I mean, this is sort of a new issue, we call it, right? I mean, so I can't imagine people are coming to this with a ton of pre-existing attitudes, which makes me wonder which pre-existing attitudes they're attaching to this. I mean, we don't do this a lot, but this is the sort of question that really begs for an open-ended follow-up.
Like, why?
Why? Yeah, no, just why? Yeah, I'm just curious. Why, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, because I mean, I can construct arguments of why people would want data centers in their communities, and they're valid arguments around, you know, the tax base, less around jobs. But I mean, I think the tax base in Texas is really is a very powerful potential argument given our, you know, the way that we fund our local governments. But, you know, given all the attitudes in general that we have here, because we asked a bunch of questions about AI and its expected impact, of which, you know, data centers are the feeding mechanism here. And again, whether people make that connection. And the attitudes towards AI are not really very positive either.
No. And I want to ask you about what you think the connection is, but say a little bit more narrowly on the data center just for a moment or a couple of beats. But I feel what you're saying in terms of the why.
Yeah.
Because obviously one wants to leap with lots of possible explanations.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of different potential things going on here. But I mean, I think the one thing that is interesting to me, and I don't watch a ton of local news. You know, I follow these things and I have probably an elite skewed view of the policy discussions. Mm-hmm. But I'll say this, I was a little bit surprised by how many people had attitudes about this.
Yeah.
Right. In other words, I felt like, you know, we had talked about this before and we've kind of kicked it around and not moved on it in terms of including it on the survey. Because it didn't feel ripe, and I think we probably missed the ripening. You know, I mean, that's okay. I mean, I'm not flagellating ourselves over it. But I mean, I do think, you know, when we had, you know, if you have 29 supportive and 56 opposed, it didn't leave a lot with people without attitudes.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that, well, but I mean,
To me, I would have thought that we were going to get, this is going to be one of those where we had maybe, you know, 70, 80% with an attitude and kind of a big.
Well.
But the independents probably looked more like what I expected, little, you know, the whole population to look like.
I mean, I think, you know, to your point is.
Maybe we were just a little late on it.
Well, I was going to say, I'm not even sure. I mean, I think we'll check the Google Trends and see what the timing looks like. But I do feel like, you know, if we had done this in April, I'm not sure that we would have had the same amount of attitudes than we have now. Just because, I mean, the attention to it seems to have been so overwhelming in the last month or two, right?
Well, we had the vote in San Marcos.
We had the vote in San Marcos. We had, you know, Abbott's weighed in. Yeah. I mean, you know, there's.
But Abbott weighed in.
Yeah.
You know, while we were. Maybe right after we got in the out of the field.
But my
view
is that Abbott weighed in because he had to weigh in because there was so much negative news.
You know what that tells me? It tells me that
they knew.
Other people were putting it in their surveys.
Yeah, they knew.
Yeah.
But I mean, I guess what I wonder is, you know, I mean, to the extent that, like, I mean, watching this story develop and the extent that there's sort of a, you know, the story of the politics of how the majority party handles this piece to this that's sort of interesting here. I mean, it seems to me like, I guess I find myself wondering, you know, from the beginning, it seems like, you know, per the reporting, you know, Abbott's people seem to have been, you know, seem to be a little disappointed, you know, with the efforts of the AI industry, data center, you know, whoever the various entities are involved in this, to make a better, to do a better job making the case for themselves. Right. Like this is sort of like the horse is out of the barn and they're like, and, you know, and I guess the point I'm saying, you're like smiling, but I think he's upset about this. If he's upset, I don't know. I'm not saying he's upset, but because Texas want, I'm going to say like Texas politicians want Texas to be pro business,
yes.
Right? There are a lot of driverless cars all over Austin right now. They're everywhere. Right. Like, cause we are cause this state is happy for you to try here.
Yeah.
As you know, in most cases, there's a couple little, you know, things. But for the most part, you know, it's like we have a ton of solar, guys. It's true. You know, we have a ton of wind. We have a lot of stuff because generally speaking, the orientation of the state is bring your business here and do it.
Right.
And so I think, you know, look, data centers and the people who want to build data centers know that about Texas. I mean, that's part
of, you know, they're big, damn lucrative projects for the people that are direct stakeholders.
Right. I mean, we talked about this a little a couple weeks ago. Yeah. I mean, about the scale of the kind of stuff that they're working on here. And so I think, you know, there is something that's very consistent about Abbott wanting these projects, especially the quote, you know, the good ones, we'll just call them, you know, whatever,
yeah,
you know, good, well-funded, non, you know, serious, non-speculative projects. He wants this here. It is in line with the brand of the state and of the party. And so, I mean, I think it's fair to say that there are some significant share of Republicans who are attached to that open for business, that's what Texas is about,
right,
do it here kind of mindset or not. But obviously, we're left just kind of speculating.
Well, there's a bunch of different things I want to tease apart,
yeah,
tease at or poke at in that. I think, you know, look, one thing to stick with the data for one more beat. One thing that was familiar, predictable, confirmatory, whatever, is the urban-rural,
yeah,
suburban breakdown on this.
Right.
Right.
That was pretty interesting. I mean, real quick, so urban environment, 36 support. Local construction of data centers, 45% opposed. That jumps up to 60% in suburban parts of the state and 62% in rural parts of the state, which actually looked almost the same.
Opposing, yeah.
Yeah, opposing, with a quarter or a little bit less supportive of building a data center.
But where they're building them or where they're talking about building them, I mean, the urban and the – or the rural and the suburban are similar. But one thing that's really interesting about both of them is that the strong opposition is intense.
Yeah.
Right, I mean, of the 60% of the suburban opposition,
yeah,
46 is strong.
Right,
registers as strong. Of the 62 in the rural areas, half.
Yeah,
50%
right,
of the overall urban share is strong. You know, that's something, and I think that's the kind of and I raise that because, you know, in the terms of like what is the governor trying to project?
I think he's trying to take
with the letter. And you were saying, you know, he's sort of disappointed. He's projecting.
Well,
he's projecting a certain amount of disappointment in kind of everybody.
Yeah, but he's trying to take control of the situation.
Yeah,
I mean,
well,
as best
exactly.
As he can,
because,
right?
And, you know, but in part because, you know, look, he signed the bills that created.
Yeah. Yeah.
This, you know, the environment, the incentive structure, and they sent a very clear signal that, well, they wanted this business, they wanted this construction, they were down with it.
Right.
And now there's this dissatisfaction. And it's dissatisfaction. I mean, I, you know, this is one of those areas where I would love to be able to disaggregate the suburbs.
Yeah.
Right? Because if we could disaggregate the suburbs into the suburbs and the exurbs, I think we'd see a continuation of this pattern.
Yeah.
Right. And these are, you know, these are Republican voters. And as you said in the breakdowns, Republican voters are split.
Well, and I think the thing is, I mean, now that we're kind of, in some ways, it's a really great way to circle back to the election piece of this, which is that, you know, in a year in which Republicans are first and foremost, I'm just saying, first and foremost, job one, get your voters to turn out. And if you think about that 2018 election, we keep turning back to the thing that saved Republicans in Texas was rural counties. They ran up the score in those rural,
yeah,
counties overwhelmingly against O'Rourke, and that tended to be the thing that seems to have, you know, people attribute that as being one of the things that really saved,
yeah,
Cruz in that election. Well, okay, you know, I'll tell you what, there's a Democrat running in every, you know, legislative district in the state right now, and I'll tell you something, one thing they're going to be saying is don't let Abbott sell out our water, our electricity to a data center. Don't,
yeah,
you know, and this, he's going to, whoever,
well,
they're running against is going to be—
raise our bills.
Raise your bills. and sell out your water to some out-of-state firm, right? That's going to be the messaging. And then it's going to be the, and then look, and here's the problem. If you're the Republican candidate, what do you say in response, given us an electorate that's split on the issue?
Right. Well, which you like, that's why Governor Abbott is saying that, you know, he's directing the, you know, the state government to make sure consumers aren't getting gouged and these guys pay for themselves. And that is, you know, you talk to the policy people, you know, there's some big questions about the capacity of you to do that without legislation.
Well, right. Well, that's it's an ongoing discussion, right?
Yeah.
But I also think that, you know, in my general rule of politics, Abbott selling you out versus no, he's directed the relevant agencies to make it's like too long.
Yeah, kind of
that's,
a long one.
That's not a good one. I always take the shorter argument, and I think in this case that's where the challenge comes in. And that's why I think he wants to get control of this, because in the rural areas, this can't be floating around in October or something, November or something that's like out of control.
Right. I mean, I think this is, you know, the response I was suggesting based on the Abbott letter and the directions to the agencies and the legislature, that's a fallback strategy at best.
Yeah, at best.
Right? I mean, I think what it means is that they're going to do what they – I think the incentives are to do what you can to keep this off the agenda, which goes back to your original, like, yeah, but small T Tallarico or low T Tallarico or whatever the,
you know,
whatever the thing of the week is.
Yeah.
You know, it's going to be before we wind up, I do want to just, you know, you raised the AI thing, and the connections between this and the AI attitudes, again, merit a lot more.
Oh, yeah.
Both a lot more polling and for at least in my mind, a little bit more careful comparison and looking at the data and different kind of combinations and stuff. But when we asked about the impact of AI in the economy, nearly half of Texas voters, 49%, said they expected AI to negatively impact the economy.
Yep.
And only 29% said they thought that it would have a positive effect. I don't know how to disentangle all that. We'd have time to go into all the other stuff because we asked about these personal impact questions.
Yeah.
And the shares looked a lot different in that. And I'm still kind of thinking that through.
Yeah.
But it's a very interesting constellation. You know, just those two results, the AI result, the data center construction in your neighborhood result, in your community result, paint a very interesting picture of Texas and its growing tech sector and what the public response is and how you triangulate that with the traditional economic development orientation of this regime, shall we say.
That's a really interesting question, right? Because, I mean, in some ways, you know, going back a beat, you know, I think historically, you know, there's not a lot of, you know, we're not too choosy when it comes to businesses here.
Well, right.
You know, we usually just say, hey, great, you know, your business.
Bring it on.
But, you know, tech is this interesting thing as an industry, right? You know, and I always think, I tell my kids this, right? You know, tech is not, you know, technology is not inherently anything, right? You use it, it can do good things, bad things. Like, you know, right? It's just, it's technology, right? Let's not, we don't need to anthropomorphize any further than it's already being done. It is what it is. But, I mean, to the extent that technology companies have, you know, let's say, come in and out of the wake of politics. I'm going to keep that now. You guys get to the end, right? Whether it's social media companies, whether it's the way that data is collected and used or not used for advertising, you know, I mean, you know, what was the other thing recently, you know, about the bandwidth stuff? I'm already forgetting what it's called. Net neutrality. I mean, there's this ways that technology is sort of intersecting and, you know, and in ways that I think just don't produce sort of the general, you know, positive reaction you expect to sort of, you know, whatever growth industries, you know, so on and so forth.
I you know, this is not Michael Dell starting a $1 billion business in his garage while he's at UT.
Right. This isn't some dorm. Yeah, exactly. That's not what this is. And so, you know, I think, you know, if you do, you know, look, whatever, I'll just be honest. Like, if you do read Axios or whatever, you know, you're reading these constant interviews that they have. I'll just be honest with these various AI people who are promoting AI, and they're throwing out all these various arguments about like the benefits, you know, where, you know, well, when the economic, you know, when all the economic gains come, you know, we're gonna have to be really careful. And just to stay,
you should spend your summer vacation designing agents to help you do your shit.
Designing agents, or like, you know, we're thinking about giving you money, but instead we're going to give you compute power. And it's like, okay, just on its face,
people are
at best ambivalent.
Yeah.
Right. And again, some of that has to do with the fact that it's amorphous and it means a lot of different things. But, you know, when we ask about all, you know, the impact of AI on various aspects of your life, your leisure, recreational time, your physical health, your current job or your work, your personal finances, your career prospects, your mental health and your personal relationships, really no more than a quarter of Texans on any of those expected a positive impact. 27% right. said a positive impact for their leisure or recreational time.
Which I thought was hilarious.
I did too. Only 12% said the same for your personal relationships. That was at the bottom. Right. But, you know, except for your current job or work, which was split, and your physical health and your recreational leisure time, more negative than positive reactions. Yeah. And mostly just no impact.
And a lot of no impact.
And yeah, that was the plurality.
To me, that was the really interesting.
Yeah, they're just saying, no impact. And so—
People aren't even bothering to make up an impact.
So, I mean, this is the other thing where we can get too far over our skis, but like, I mean, it makes me want to say, I'm already saying, I don't think this is right, but you know, if people don't see a positive impact to AI— And yet these companies are asking their communities to fork over significant resources to produce basically the machinery for AI. It's reasonable for those people to be saying, why? I'm going back to the first, why?
I mean, I was talking to somebody about this and, you know, and I was kind of doing something I probably shouldn't have, just kind of thinking it through in real time.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, the cost-benefit analysis, if you ask people about a data center—
mm-hmm.
And they've already got some negative impressions.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a hard sell.
Yeah.
And I think as this debate grows, there's a lot of people with attitudes already. And, you know better than I, you know, this dynamic that people are going to start filtering information. If they've already got a reasonably well-founded negative predisposition towards these things— mm-hmm. It's going to be hard to change their mind. They're going to start selectively picking evidence. And it goes to where we were a few minutes ago in terms of like, well, you know, there's a lot of ways to—
Yeah.
There's a lot of ways to think about what the impact of these things is, whether it's, you know, strictly personally economic, like, you know, mm-hmm. your utility bills.
Right.
If you're in one of these exurban rural areas, whether it's this big thing that's right there, and you know, for what you think it's loud, or it's using too much water, or you know, you just think it's an eyesore,
right?
It's going to be hard to turn this ship. Now, a lot of the stakeholders that are going to be trying to turn the ship
mm-hmm.
have a lot of resources, but they got their work cut out for them as of now.
But this is that's true. I mean, the other interesting— I don't know if you see Quorum report today. There's a headline, I didn't read it, but it was— so I apologize, it's terrible. But I was busy, okay, releasing the poll. But one of the things it was saying was, it's kind of not surprising, saying, you know, this idea that, well, you know, the anti-data center thing is really Chinese misinformation, potentially.
That's yeah.
Did you say— well, but like, and again, you laugh, but I mean, because
no,
it's funny.
No, I'm laughing because it's totally apt to the discussion. It's
right,
like,
so if you—
So what can we do?
This is the Chinese trying to make us less competitive.
Right.
Got it.
Yeah.
But I mean, honestly, when I say that out loud, it's like, that's a pretty good argument.
It's the you know, I've been reading all these spy novels, as you kind of know. You know, it's kind of like, oh yeah, and the big kind of, you know, shadow world out there. You know, you soften them up by turning the public against data centers and then invade Taiwan.
I was just thinking, how do you—
And that's not implausible, but
no, I was saying,
as an effort.
Or it's like, you know, this is the Muslims. We kid. But this also speaks to the challenge in some ways of the environment Republicans are facing. Is they're looking to take attitudes that already exist, that they know exist within their electorate, and they're trying to figure out novel ways to elicit them given constraints imposed on them by the environment, right? We can't, you know, again, we said this before, can't talk about hundreds of thousands of undocumented immigrants crossing the border. We can't talk about undocumented immigrants committing crimes in all the cities because Donald Trump is taking care of that. So we have to talk about something else. Okay, well, should we talk about the economy and economic success? Nope, can't talk about that, right? So what are we going to talk about? And so part of this is, you know, we've said this all the time, if you study attitudes, you can't tell people what to think.
Right.
It's very, very challenging to sort of, you can't just put an attitude in someone's head. It's I wouldn't say it's impossible or it's conditions, but it's not something that you do on a mass level. So really, the most effective messages are always the ones that exist in people's brains already. And so that's why we're sort of curious about what is it that's drawing these Republicans to these sort of pro-data center attitudes? And is this something that is potentially, and I'll tell you, if anybody knows, it's Abbott because he pays a lot of money for research, but is this the sort of thing that they can use, whatever those underlying attitudes are, to bring along the others and kind of nullify this issue?
Yeah.
I don't know. It seems like a lot of work when you just want to be kind of, you know, running a campaign.
and at a practical level, you want to be, you know, we've talked about this a lot in here, and you kind of alluded to this. I mean, as Republican candidates in the environment we're talking about, which is, you know, not necessarily red alert yet, but, you know, the Senate race it is, but, it, you know, statewide, you know, we're on yellow alert, you know, shields are up.
It's a yellow flag.
And you're looking to play to your strengths, this thing with the data centers and the attached attitudes around AI that may are somehow connected.
Maybe,
you know, but, you know, out there at least, at, you know, they're at least vibrating at similar frequencies,
right.
Let's put it that
way.
Yeah,
that's right.
Right. It complicates one of your go-to arguments.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, and I think it's interesting, it's problematic, and, you know, it's a real policy issue. And, you know, at the same time that the campaign calculations are going on, you know, the mobilization on this issue right now is full steam ahead for the legislative session that's coming.
Yeah.
There's no two ways about that.
That's gonna be something.
That, Josh, thank you very much for coming in on a summer day.
Oh, always. I love it.
And thanks to all of you for listening. Thanks to our excellent staff here in the audio studio in Liberal Arts ITS at the University of Texas. Appreciate all of you. I can't remember if we're podcasting next week or not, but, you know, we'll let you know. we're on some kind of a summer schedule with travel, et cetera, and
I don't think so.
But we got a lot to talk about because I won't say we've just scratched the surface. We actually covered a lot more than I thought we were gonna in this. But there's a lot more in this poll. We barely talked about the Trump numbers. We had some interesting results on abortion. We checked in on Iran. So there's a lot more to talk about. So we'll be back sometime in the next couple weeks. In the meantime, do go to the website, texaspolitics.utexas.edu. Extensive report on this poll. And as always, lots and lots and lots of graphics that you can download, use for teaching, presentations, handouts, cocktail parties. So thanks again, everybody. And we'll be back again soon with another Second Reading podcast. Soonish. The Second Reading Podcast is a production of the Texas Politics Project at the University of Texas at Austin.